So you're running out of closet space. The good news? You don't need to stop shopping. You just need to start selling with The RealReal. The RealReal is the world's largest and most trusted resource for authenticated luxury resale. Whether it's that mini bag that can't even fit your phone, or those boots you never fully broke in, The RealReal handles everything from photography and copywriting to shipping and pricing. So you can just sit back, get paid, and make room for things that actually feel like you. And with 10,000 plus new arrivals every single day from top designers like Prada, Celine, Louis Vuitton, and Loewe, all for up to 90% off retail, you're bound to find something perfectly on brand to fill that extra closet space with. Plus, right now, you can get an extra $100 to shop when you sell for the first time. Make room for what feels like you. Go to TheRealReal.com to start selling and get your extra $100 to keep shopping at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
Arayo Original Podcast.
You have been Kim Kardashian's hairstylist for years.
I was working with Rita Ora. Got an email from JLo's team. I was really excited, but also incredibly insecure. If I'd have just given in to the fear, I probably wouldn't be here now. The brain is very powerful. You can really convince yourself that you are something. If someone tells you something's bad, you know, the last thing you want to do is be a version of that. A lot of my teen years and early 20s was running from myself and hiding from myself and trying to delete my past. A lot of my journey has been about proving other people wrong. It started with my mom. I saw herself let go and stop and look. She didn't recognize the reflection looking back at herself. She forgot those things that she carried. I thought I knew who I was. I had a family, I had a life, yeah. And I felt good about it. If I could have, you know, taken that piece out of me, I would have. I really didn't want to sort of go down that road. Is this it? Is this who I truly am? But once you realize that your roots don't define you and your past doesn't define you and you can change the narrative and you can change the story at any age, it's really powerful.
Hello and welcome back to Rise with Roxy. Today, I'm joined by someone whose talent and vision have shaped global beauty culture. Chris Appleton is one of the most sought-after hairstylists in the world, whose clients include Kim Kardashian, Jennifer Lopez, and Dua Lipa, to name just a few. But Chris's journey isn't just about glamour. It's a story of resilience, focus, reinvention, and the courage to keep going when you've hit rock bottom. In this episode, he opens up about identity, shame, and why he believes that your roots don't define you. If you have big ambitions, if you're reinventing yourself, or if you're building something from scratch, this conversation will light a fire in you. If you like the show, please do make sure to subscribe and follow at Rise with Roxy on Instagram or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, let's rise. Chris Appleton, welcome to Rise with Roxy.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am so honored, and we're here in LA at the One Hotel West Hollywood.
Yeah.
It's like 8 a.m. Mm-hmm. You're about to do the audio recording for your brand new book, Your Roots Don't Define You.
Yeah.
How are you feeling?
Very excited. I've been waiting for this moment for a long time. It's exciting to be able to put my voice behind it to make this book come to life, because it's been a little project in the works for a while. And I'm excited for people to finally kind of realize what it's all about and how it can help them. I'm dyslexic, so I was a little like, oh, the audio might be a challenge, mm-hmm. but it's going to be good.
Yeah.
Positivity.
Yeah.
I feel great about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So when I was reading your story and listening to you, I really felt like, firstly, I was so fascinated by your journey. And I think that you have such a public persona. You have so much success. You are, you know, like world renowned in your field. You are the best of the best. And when I really found out what your kind of story was, it seemed to me that your life has these kind of two halves. So there's a life before you moved to LA, before you came out, and there's a life after.
Yeah.
And I think that your success is really comes from that life before that and all the resilience that built for you.
Yeah.
So I want to start there. I want to start at the beginning of your journey. Mm-hmm. What was your early life like?
I think a lot of people have a perception of Chris Appleton on social media, where I guess, you know, there's this idea that you work with these celebrities, you know, you post these pictures where you're at great events and life looks great. And social media, to an extent, is a lie, because we're kind of posting and sharing the best part of ourselves. You know, to wake up and post a picture of you a headache or you feeling insecure is a little tougher to do than to post a picture of you looking great being somewhere. So I think, you know, in this book, Your Roots Don't Define You, there's going to be a big awakening to realize my real life and where I come from and how I ended up here in Hollywood and, you know, known as Hollywood's hairstylist. Because it really didn't start off like that. It started off with a very real life in Middle England. I'm one of five kids. I'm the middle child. And I think I really felt very lost as a child. My family was, you know, very poor. And I think there was a lot of generational trauma that was kind of passed on and inherited. My parents did the best version they could, but, you know, they didn't have the best steps or sort of shown to them as children. So I think a lot of my early childhood, I felt very misunderstood. I felt different. I didn't feel like my brothers. They were out there playing football and doing, you know, boys things, and my girls were out there doing girls things. I kind of felt somewhere in between. I kind of felt that I just didn't belong. And I remember looking outside the window. I must have been around six, and there's a defining moment where I just felt very lost. I felt very misunderstood. And a lot of the healing I've done as an adult was going back to that little boy at the window. It was going back to him and giving him some of the words he needed to hear at the time. And I think a lot of my journey has been about proving other people wrong. At school, I was bullied because I started doing hair when I was 13. I started really young. Partly because I was so excited to find something I was good at. I was dyslexic at school. You know, I think being told I was stupid back then, no one really understood what it meant, because I didn't traditionally learn the way other kids learn. You just get labeled with stupid. You know, I was in the special needs class. I mean, even that being called what it's called is kind of, you know, very harsh on your soul. So I think for a long time, I was really eager to prove to people that I wasn't stupid. And I was also called gay a lot of school because I did hair. It was like, you're gay, you must be gay. And it was before I even thought about sexuality. You know, I wasn't really sort of thinking about who I was in that realm, or I wasn't really given the chance to develop it, because it was very quickly labeled as a bad thing. So I was like, well, I'm going to prove everyone that I'm not gay and that I'm not stupid. You know, I'm kind of, I just got so focused. And the brain is very powerful. You can really convince yourself that you are something. And if someone tells you something's bad, you know, the last thing you want to do is be a version of that. So I think a lot of my teen years and early 20s was running from myself and hiding from myself and trying to delete my past. And I think in writing this book, it was actually healing to go back to that with a different perspective. And we spoke briefly earlier about the voice in your head. And that voice in your head, I think most people can relate to this listening. God, it can be mean. You know, the things you say to yourself, I look fat, or, you know, I feel ugly, or why is my hair doing this? Oh my God, my one eye is smaller than the other. Or why is that arm doing that? Was this hip sticking out here? And we all have that inner voice and that inner dialogue. But for me, going back to myself, going back to that little boy at the window, you know, it was very healing, because I would never speak to him like that.
Yeah.
And sometimes as adults, we forget that we are that little child. That little child lives within us. And realizing that was very powerful for me. It was very, it was a very healing tool, but it was also a very powerful tool to sort of, I guess, fall in love with yourself. And we have this context of, like, you know, you must love yourself. And sometimes I struggled with that. I was like, well, I don't think we should, you know, think too much of ourselves. But I think it's a very different meaning to actually truly love yourself. And it kind of, I still have that voice. You know, I sat down and you said, you look great. I said, I feel like a whale in this leather. But I can now manage it. It doesn't last as long. I can laugh it off, because I'm like, oh, that's just that voice. You know, as a natural fact, I look good. I feel good. You know, and I think part of healing, it's not as though you're the end result. I'm sure maybe you're not. Maybe you'll disagree. I don't know. I don't know if anyone is. But you just learn how to handle that voice. Absolutely. You learn how to let it go and then move on.
Absolutely.
Rather than let it indulge in you and completely take over.
That's absolutely right. And I totally agree that I think inner child work and connecting to that inner self, that younger self, is so, so powerful, because really our past, our experiences, they have so much influence over how we respond to everything in our lives today.
Yeah.
And until we kind of really understand the patterns, the triggers, the wounds, it's really hard to actually live fully in the moment. I want to go back to when you were 13 and you decided you got your first job in a salon, which is also so young to be working. How did you actually get into hair? How did you know that you were good at it?
I think a lot of, again, what I did was I felt loved by doing things for other people. So I used to do my mum's hair, and I'd kind of try and make her look glamorous, because life was so far from that. I wanted to somehow make her look like a Hollywood star, something I saw on the TV or in the magazine. So I'd do her hair and, you know, do these little updos and put pieces in and stuff. And I'd be like, "Mom, look in the mirror." And I saw that when she looked in the mirror, she stood taller, you know, and her shoulders sort of went back. And there was a pause, because there's this thing called the mirror test. So many of us look in the mirror maybe 10 times a day, and we glance and we see ourselves and we move on. Not many people stop and really take a look and ask themselves, is this it? Is this who I truly am? Because a lot of the time that reflection is telling us something. And a lot of the time we don't even know how we got there. It's old habits we've inherited from when we were kids, where we're told we look a certain way, or we should do this, or we shouldn't do that. And we carry that throughout our whole adult lives. And a lot of the success in what I've done in my job is really just stopping people and making them look in the mirror, but truly look, and helping them see themselves and be seen. So it started with that. It started with my mom. I saw herself let go and stop and look. She didn't recognize the reflection looking back at herself. And that made her feel a certain way, because she forgot that she was, you know, an orphan child, or, you know, she forgot those things that she carried in her past, and it empowered her. And I remember thinking, God, this feels like a superpower. I love this. I feel like a superhero. Like, I get to make people look good. That's great. But I get to make people feel good. And that was really the, like, addiction to me. I was like addicted to making people feel good, because it was so empowering, and I love to see them come out of themselves. So yeah, it all started with my mum.
That's so, do you still do her hair?
Yeah, when she comes over, they're always coming over, they're looking to LA. And yeah, I still do it, and you know, she's still, I still see that happen. Yeah. It doesn't matter who I've done, if it's Miss Jones that comes into the salon, a celebrity, a model at Fashion Week, or, you know, a cancer patient that lost their hair, because, you know, it's all about identity and it's all about storytelling. And I think that's the magic of sitting in the hairstylist chair.
Yeah.
A lot of people say, I see my hairstylist like a therapist. Mm-hmm. And what a lot of people don't realize is when you sit down in that chair, there's something that happens where you really see yourself. It's that moment that happens every now and again where you stop and you really look. And I think that's the very powerful part about sitting in the hairstylist chair, because you're actually at the right place of beginning to tell your story and really look at yourself. You can't change your story and you can't reinvent yourself if you don't start where you're at and knowing what you want to do and how you want to change that. And part of my job is helping that come out in other people.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of hairstylists that I used to work with, I saw they would go to their client and they'd be like, "Hey, what are we doing today? Same as usual." And I'd see how that person would react, because they'd be sitting in a chair. And I think it's that time where you want to be seen and you're hoping someone's going to kind of, you know, give you their ideas and thoughts about how you should look. And they'd be like, "Same as usual." And I'd see the client's reaction would be like, "Yeah. Yeah, same as usual," you know, because they're not being seen. And I never wanted to be that hairstylist. So it really started with me just being like, well, who have you always wanted to be? Or who do you aspire to look like? Is there any hair icons you have? It would just be starting with a point outside of them.
Yeah.
And a lot of people would be confused, because I would talk about something and they'd talk about someone that maybe they love their hair, and they'd instantly come back to like, "But, well, I know I can't have that." Mm-hmm. I know I can't do that. I can't go blonde. Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, "Oh, why is that?" And that, "Well, I just can't, you know, someone once told them they couldn't." And it all goes back to their childhood. It all goes back to them being told a version of themselves, and they've carried that throughout their whole lives. But when you break that down to them, it might not even happen instantly in that chair. They may not jump for, you know, change, but I always notice, like, the next time they came in for an appointment, they're like, "You know, I've been thinking about what you said about going a bit lighter, and I think I'd like to do that. You know, you start to open up these paths for change. Mm-hmm. And it is an external thing. A lot of people think what I do is just external. It's really not. So much of it is internal. Mm-hmm. Because you're actually breaking down some of these beliefs we've had as a child. Mm-hmm. And it takes time to do that. Yeah. It doesn't happen instantly. But once you start and once you see it, mm-hmm. you can't unsee it.
I love that. So really young, you find this passion, not just for, you know, harnessing a skill that you have, which is hair, but yep. for actually helping people feel better. And that is so kind of like purposeful. And as a young child, you're going to the salon, I suppose you're working on weekends. What is it like at school for you at that time? Were you making friends? Did you feel like how bad was the bullying?
It was pretty intense and consistent. I mean, as a kid, like, I remember there was a point in like your primary school where I felt happy, and then when I went on to the upper school is I think when kids start to sort of pick fault with everyone else and mm-hmm. anyone that's a little different,
yeah,
they get it. And I think I was the one that got it. Like, I had a job at 13, I did hair. I always had girlfriends because I think I related to the girls, and like I was always kind of like, you know, they wanted me to do the hair,
yeah.
and stuff. And it was a lot, and it was really shoved down. I remember leaving school and I just was having fun with my friends, and we were walking to the bus and these guys jumped me and they punched me in the back of the head and shoved me into the fence and kicking me and spitting on me. And like, I remember just walking home after and I just remember thinking to myself, like, why do people want to be so mean to people? Well, I've not done anything. I didn't really know them, but they just, I guess it was a power thing for them that they wanted to do that. So the bullying got really bad, and I remember just feeling so like I didn't want to be who I was. I didn't want to be me because that something felt like that was wrong. Because when society is treating you like you're wrong, it felt really paralyzing.
But could you understand? Because I know I've heard you speak before, and I think what's really interesting is some people might assume that when you say I didn't want to be me, you meant specifically about being gay. But you didn't necessarily know that you were gay at that time. Is that right?
I didn't even entertain it because I was told from a young age it was wrong.
Yeah.
And what I think society knew about gay back then, I grew up in a smaller town. It wasn't London. Mm-hmm. It was a city outside of London. Mm-hmm. And the idea of being gay then, it was like, I think when Princess Diana was shaking guys' hands and they had HIV, she didn't wear gloves. And it was great, big news because it was like, you can catch HIV like that, you know, gay men have HIV. And it was just a really scary thing to be. And I was like, oh, I don't want to have any of that. So even before I was like a sexually active person, I was just like, oh, that's bad.
Yeah.
I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, I just was very, like, I don't want to do that. And, you know, again, with the dyslexia thing of being told I was stupid at school, I didn't want to be stupid. You know, I wanted to, and I think that's what motivated me to get a job. And when I found something that I liked doing and I was good at, I was like, I'm going to be the best at this.
Yeah.
But a lot of it was to prove other people, that they were wrong.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, like I say, a lot of it was about running away from myself. And in part of writing this book and the lessons I've learned along the way, I really wanted to help encourage people to know that, you know, your roots really don't define you. They can if you allow them to. Mm. But once you realize that your roots don't define you and your past doesn't define you and you can change the narrative and you can change the story at any age, it's really powerful. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter who you are.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So you then meet the mother of your children and you have two kids really quite young.
Yeah.
How old were you when you had your kids and how did you meet their mom?
I was 19 and I actually worked with Kate and we had a relationship for 9 years and it was great. And we're still best friends now.
Yeah.
She just came over and we celebrated my daughter's 21st birthday.
Oh my gosh.
And I just said, you know, I think we did pretty good because they're two amazing kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, it wasn't always easy for them. You know, I felt a lot of shame about who I was as an adult because I didn't want to bring anything what I experienced and that negativity on them. Mm-hmm. Because again, as kids, anything that's slightly different, you know, even if your parent, like your dad's gay, it's like, that's bad. You know, a lot of kids don't like that. And it's, it's good reason, you know, they think to bully people about. And I just didn't want to ever bring that onto them. So that was a really hard thing to navigate. But mine and Kate's relationship has been ultimately very close all of the time. And, you know, our biggest goal was to protect the kids and make sure they had the best experience in life. And I truly, it's one of the, my greatest gifts is feeling like we did a good job.
Yeah.
And we have such a good relationship, and it's a different dynamic, but I love that. And I'm just incredibly proud of what we created as a family.
Well, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
So what, I mean, at 19, most kids are sort of going out, partying. You're a young dad working. How did you find becoming a dad so young?
I just loved Kate, and I just felt like it was the next thing to do. I don't know, like, she fell pregnant and I was just so excited, but I'd never had a doubt in my mind. And then when they were born, you know, everyone can relate to when your child's born, it just changed my life. And I very quickly realized it wasn't about me then, it was about someone else and putting them first. And that was also motivation to do well at what I do. I wanted them to be proud of me. And I think it just felt very organic to me. I don't know. It just felt very, it never felt strange to be a young dad. Like, if I think about it now, I can look back and I'll be like, oh my God, I was so young.
Yeah.
I just think I was, as a kid, so motivated to be a better version of myself, to be the best version of myself, to be different. Yeah. I didn't want to just get a job and work 9 to 5. I wanted to create, and I wanted to help change people's lives and connect. And I was always very ambitious. So I think I'm still like that. I still can't just sit still. Maybe it's ADHD. I don't know. I just always am ready to move on to the next thing and, you know, evolve as a human being. And I think that's really important. And that's what excites me.
Yeah.
You know, I never want to just feel like, I hate the word fine or okay. Like, if someone said, like, if you said to me, like, you look okay today, I would probably just go change. You know, I think it's so middle of the ground. I didn't ever just want an okay life.
Yeah.
I wanted a life that, you know, at the end, when I look back, that I could, you know, look back and have memories, not dreams. I never wanted a dream to be fulfilled, because life's so short and we're so lucky to be here. I just want to create those magical moments with the people I love, you know?
Yeah. So in the next kind of like 6 years, from 19 till 25, you're going through your own personal discovery.
Yeah.
And I think it was at 26 that you came out.
Yeah.
Could you talk us through that kind of journey to perhaps coming to terms with your own sexuality, and then the experience of opening up about it to other people?
Yeah. I mean, I think it got to a point where I just didn't really feel like myself. Like, you know, you can run away for a long time and you can convince yourself there's a version of you when you try and live it. But there's something that happens, and something happened to me. It was like 26, where I just felt like something just wasn't right. And it wasn't until mine and Kate's relationship broke down and I started to go out a lot more again, and experiencing things that I was never allowing myself. So my first gay experience, and I remember being really confused by it. 'Cause it's not as though I had a preconceived idea in terms of my expectations of sexuality, because I was always around gay men, like in, you know, the hairstyling industry or the beauty industry. I wasn't, you know, wasn't not around it. I just didn't think I was into it until something happened. And I was actually drunk at the time. I'd been out and we had a night out, and I thought, oh, I was just drunk. This guy tried to kiss me, and I was like, oh, last night was crazy.
Right.
And then I remember we built a friendship, and there was no sexualness in it, but it was the first time that I think I allowed myself to even become close to feeling feelings for a guy. And that was just really confusing for me, because I thought I knew who I was. I had a family, I had a life, and I felt good about it. And I mean, honestly, if I could cut it out of me, if I could have, you know, taken that piece out of me, I would have. I really didn't want to sort of go down that road. I was very avoidant about it. But once I sort of delve into it, you couldn't not. And I realized that I wasn't, you know, being authentic to myself. And I think part of that was, you know, being bullied as a kid and being told I was something, just pushing so hard against it and, you know, reprogram my brain to truly to believe it until I couldn't. Because I think you can only fake it for so long.
Yeah.
And like I say, it wasn't, people say to me all the time, oh, you knew. I genuinely didn't. Yeah. I genuinely did not know. I don't know if I brainwashed myself or what, but I genuinely.
You said how powerful the mind is.
It's so powerful.
And the fact that.
I was just like, that's bad. I'm not doing that. I didn't even allow myself. It wasn't, I was like meeting up with guys or watching gay porn or engage in any of that. Not because I didn't want to. I just didn't think about it.
You'd shut down your mind to even the possibility.
Totally.
Because you'd associated. You know,
it's a bad thing.
Yeah. Do you think in many ways that made it even more challenging for you to kind of go through that realization because you had already built a life that was so different to who you really were?
Yeah, 100%. Because then it's not about you. Like I knew having kids, when I had kids, I knew it was never about me. You know, I knew it was always going to be about them and they would always come first. So your number one thing as a parent you want to do is protect your kids. Mm. So the thought of me putting any harm or effect on them from my lifestyle was just against anything I believed in. And that killed me. That was probably the hardest thing. I think dealing with that and going through having to tell them was just the worst moment of my life. It was something I never wanted to do because it didn't really matter what anyone else said anymore, but their opinion and what I was, you know, putting on them was the most important. I didn't want to ever affect them. So I think going through something like that, I don't think I could have got any lower or felt any worse about myself. And I think there was a real defining moment where I just gave in. I didn't want to, I couldn't have hated myself anymore. I couldn't have tried to run away from myself. I couldn't have tried to, you know, not be here anymore. I just got to the lowest point. And I think when you get to that lowest point, I just thought, well, if I'm still going to be here, if I'm going to live on this earth, I'm going to be a human being, I have to just let go. Mm. I'd not let go since I think that, you know, 10-year-old kid that started to get bullied at school. I'd not let go since then. I'd held on so tight and I just let go. And I didn't really know what was ahead, but I know that letting go was the first step of healing and just becoming. And I was like, what about instead of just hating who I am and hating that, you know, this thing inside me, I felt like it was this thing, you know, this gay thing, like this gay urge. I was like, what about if I just accept it and it's who I am. Mm. Like I'm just gay and I don't know what the next step is, but how's about I just start with that? Mm. How's about I just start with letting go? And it was like a lightness in my body. It was like, I remember it definingly being a moment where I just moved on to the next step of my life. Because you can't reinvent yourself unless you're really honest about where you're at.
Yeah.
We can fake it. You can fake a version of that, but you can't truly change it. And I think the thing about self-help is change is really hard.
Yeah.
It's not because we're having to reprogram our brain. And the brain, like I said, is so powerful. Mm-hmm. And reprogramming that takes time and consistency and, you know, dedication and also honesty. And I don't think everyone is always ready to be honest with themselves. So I think in that moment, I just had to be really honest with myself at where I was at. I was very confused about how I got there. I was very confused about how I had been so avoidant about that and completely closed off. But I knew I was in the darkest place of my life. So it was the beginning of stepping out of that. Mm. It was a tiny step into stepping out of that.
Yeah.
And then the journey was long. The journey is evolving all the time and healing is a brutal process. It's not easy, but the best thing I ever did. And I think coming back to yourself and redefining who you are and realizing you're not defined from your past is so empowering. Mm. And what a lot of people don't realize is that a small part of that happens every time they sit in the hairstylist chair, or especially when they sat in mine.
Yeah.
Because like I said, I could see it in other people. I just didn't ever see it in myself. Yeah. I saw other people in the mirror. I just didn't look at myself.
Yeah.
And in that moment, in that darkest moment where I decided to let go, I think I looked at myself in the mirror and I took a long, hard look. Yeah.
I think people underestimate how much courage and bravery it takes and would have taken you to get to that point.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, certainly I believe from a manifestation point of view, it's only when we step into our most authentic selves that we become magnetic, that totally. Life suddenly starts to unfold the way it's supposed to. Mm-hmm. Because until then, you're in this constant state of resistance.
Yeah.
And so you can't attract and allow things to flow the way that they should.
Which is exhausting, by the way.
Oh, it's exhausting. Yeah.
People don't realize, like, and it may be people listening now, if anyone's listening, you notice maybe your shoulders are up, or you actually like relax, like if you actually just let go. So much of our lives were like this.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't even realize, but maybe practice it now, like just letting go and just being, like feeling your feet on the ground, like looking at where you're at in your life and actually just really being in it.
What would your advice be to anyone listening that is struggling with opening up about their sexuality? Because although I think things are so different now to when they were, you know, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think that there is so much more acceptance and open-mindedness. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there are still people that might carry that kind of fear around coming out. What would your advice be to them?
I think in any area of their life, whether it be sexuality, or maybe it's just a relationship you're unhappy in, or maybe it's a job or a friendship, or the friendship you have with yourself and the relationship you have with yourself, I think for me, just understanding and realizing that you're not defined by your past story is one of the most powerful things you can do. And just let go and be in that moment and just really hear yourself say those words, that you're not defined by your past, can just really be so life-changing in that moment, just to realize that you can change at any time. There's people watching this probably think they're too old, or they've been married for so long now, so they could never get out of it, or, you know, they've been this way, so they can't change. And I just want to tell you, like, I've seen people do it at all ages and stages of their life. And a lot of people don't necessarily do it until something scary happens, like they have cancer, mm-hmm. or like they're faced with death. And that something like that can usually shock people into being like, oh my God, I've been married to this person all this time. I hate that. You know, I'm not happy.
Yeah,
or,
yeah.
Oh my God, I have been so mean to myself. Or, you know, I've been in these friendships, which I don't even like these people. Or I've never traveled. I've never stepped outside my comfort zone. And a lot of people can change from that, because it's the one time again that makes you stop. It stops you in your tracks and you're like, oh my God, I might not have the choice to be here. And I think when you realize that life is really short, and you can change at any time in your life, it's incredibly powerful. And that's what I'm hoping I know people will get from the book, is it really delves into how you look at that, how you look at A, what your roots are, and B, then how you can redefine yourself and not be defined by that. Mm-hmm. You will walk away knowing that you can rebuild a version of yourself, one that you feel proud of and that you feel happy in.
Yeah.
And that was my gift to people that I guess don't get to sit in my chair. Mm-hmm. And from, you know, I'm 42 now, I started this when I was 13, all these years of experience of working with, you know, the general public, working with celebrities, or working with models, or we all have insecurities, we all have fears, we all have those voices in our head when we sit in the mirror. Mm-hmm. But, you know, navigating that into something that is a positive experience and can, you know, be something that is a moment of change rather than a moment of doom.
Yeah.
I think is very powerful.
Absolutely.
So you're running out of closet space. The good news? You don't need to stop shopping. You just need to start selling with The RealReal. The RealReal is the world's largest and most trusted resource for authenticated luxury resale. Whether it's that mini bag that can't even fit your phone, or those boots you never fully broke in, The RealReal handles everything from photography and copywriting to shipping and pricing. So you can just sit back, get paid, and make room for things that actually feel like you. And with 10,000 plus new arrivals every single day from top designers like Prada, Celine, Louis Vuitton, and Loewe, all for up to 90% off retail, you're bound to find something perfectly on brand to fill that extra closet space with. Plus, right now, you can get an extra $100 to shop when you sell for the first time. Make room for what feels like you. Go to TheRealReal.com to start selling and get your extra $100 to keep shopping at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
Okay, so I want to get into your career journey because you are the best of the best. And I am always fascinated of like, how does someone get to that point? You know, you grew up in Leicester, working at a salon. You then move to Hollywood and it's just like, wow, to see your journey is kind of so inspiring. Can you just walk us through how the fuck did you get here?
Oh, God. I mean, I was working in the salon. And I remember, again, I was just always very eager. I got to the top of the price scale and then I was a manager. And then I was thinking, what else is there? Like, I love this job. I want to help more people. And I remember then started to do like the British Hairdressing Awards. And I won a few, like I think my region of British Hairdresser of the Year. And then I did a TV show called Hairdresser of the Year. It was a bit like Bake Off, but of hair. So it was like a competition-based thing. And I remember going to London. I still lived in Leicester at the time. So I traveled up and down on the train. I was a dad, a working dad. So I was just trying to make it happen. And we did this competition. And I remember then it went on TV and I ended up winning this competition. And then that was just like a leapfrog into, I guess, what was outside of the salon. I was like, oh, there's this world of fashion where you get to do hair for editorial, or you can do models on runway shows and you can do the covers of magazines. And each step was really different because when you're in the salon, you come in and a lot of the time it's like, you know, the client comes in, you have a consultation, you wash your hair, you sit down, you cut the hair, you blow dry. Fashion kind of changed it all on its head. Like sometimes you'd have 2 hours to do the model, but then sometimes like the last 10 minutes before a show, the rest of the models would come in and you'd have to do the same look, but you'd cut out all those steps of washing the hair, but you'd just have to work with the hair as it was and make it work. So that kind of was like a fast track into doing hair in a very different way. And then I started to do editorial hair, and editorial hair is very different to like real life hair. Editorial hair will be like one piece of hair that lays across the face and it just looks beautiful in a picture. But in real life, you'd be like, you know, like, you know, what is that? So I started to learn all these different ways and how you could tell stories with hair, like in a picture or in a magazine and, you know, create moments. And then I was working with Rita Ora and I kind of worked for her one day because I did a magazine shoot. It was like a Sunday Times magazine or something. Yeah. And the makeup artist said, oh, I work with Rita. She needs a hairstylist. And I was like, well, I'm available. So I remember just booking a hotel and staying in London because I still didn't live in London. And I remember thinking like, oh, I could do these different hairstyles. And I was waiting for this call and they confirmed it at like 12 o'clock at night because she was traveling in. And the next day I did a hair and it went well. And then I stayed with her for like the next 2 years. And I think at the time I was changing her hair a lot. It was short, then long, and then it was pink and then it was blue. And social media started, so I was posting the work all the time.
Yeah.
And I remember I got an email from JLo's team saying,
sorry, what?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I said.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I looked at my emails and it was like Jennifer Lopez is doing her Vegas tour and she would, you know, want to work with you. And I remember I ignored the first email because I thought, oh, this is probably just spam or something. And then I got another one and I remember thinking like, how does JLo know who I am?
That is extraordinary.
Yeah, I'm just Chris, like from Leicester. And I remember, again, it was that moment where
I saw myself. No offense.
It was social media. I guess it's the power of social media because you know, she didn't follow me, but she was looking. People are always looking. How often do we end up on someone's page? I don't know how we got here, but we're kind of, maybe it's their fitness regime or maybe it's their, I don't know, their philosophy or their self-help or whatever it is. We end up in all these like different places on social media.
What can I just say? It's such a good point for somebody listening that's got their business, got their talent, that is doesn't bother posting on social because they're like, who's going to care?
Yeah.
You never know.
Never know.
JLo could be watching.
Absolutely. You know, probably is an amount of people that fall on your page, you know, unexpectedly. So it was just the right time. And I remember thinking to myself, well, maybe I can do this. Maybe I could go to America and take it to the next level. So I finished working with Rita on the 23rd of December and I moved to LA on the 24th of December.
Whoa. Wait, did you go to Vegas with JLo?
No, I missed it because I didn't respond, but I just remember thinking, well, maybe I could just try and be there.
Right.
So I moved to America. On the 24th, I packed 2 suitcases. I had a whole furnished apartment that I just worked so hard to do and I just left it. It was rented. I left it, went to LA with two suitcases, as much as stuff I could fit in, and was ready.
And what was your goal?
Moved to Hollywood to take things to the next level and I guess work with, you know, maybe I could work with J-Lo. Maybe I could work with Kim Kardashian. Maybe I could work with these celebrities and, you know, tell my story more. Like, you know, do more things in Hollywood. It was always kind of the dream, you know, because that is what I used to do to my mom's house. I used to try and make her look like a Hollywood star. So maybe I could be in Hollywood. Maybe I could do it. I moved there and I didn't do anything for the first 3 months and I spent my money. All my money went. I had kids, so I couldn't like afford not to have, you know, to provide for them. So it was really at the end of my chance here in Hollywood. And I was like very upset. I've spent most days crying. But I remember I got a call from Christina Aguilera's team to do a hair for The Voice. And I was really excited, but also incredibly insecure and not at all confident. You know, I just, even though I'd spent my whole life learning my craft, I was 30, I'd done every course and hair thing you could imagine, I still just felt like that little boy that felt a bit lost standing outside the window that lived in me. I wasn't really looking at him too much, but that was always there. So I was on the way to do a hair for The Voice and I remember just feeling really insecure. And I spoke to Kate, I rang her because, you know, we're, like I said, best friends. We still were on the phone all the time. And I said, I'm really nervous. And she said, look, Chris, if you think about it, like you can do this. She's like, but the reality of it is if you don't make this work, you got to come home. And I remember thinking, she's right. So I turned up for glam. There was 3 hours and the makeup artist went in and I didn't get invited in until the last 20 minutes before the live show. So I'd been sitting there for a couple of hours, just spewing and feeling, if I wasn't confident when I arrived, I was on the floor by the time I walked in. I crawled into the trailer. So I was thinking to myself, my hair's probably going to look great. Because what's the alternative? I don't know. I only have 20 minutes. Surely it's done. And it wasn't. It wasn't great. It was ready to be done. You know, I was like, wow, okay. So I prepped. I did so much prep work. And I said, oh, you know, I'd love to try this wig. Have you ever tried a wig? And she's like, I don't like wigs. And I was like, oh, why would you like anything I've got to do? I was like, she sees me. She sees little Chris standing at the window. Like, she can see I'm just trying. She can see I've just got a dream. And she can see through me. She's worked with everyone and the best people in the industry. Why would she want to work with me? And then I had this moment, it was one of the only times it's really happened. And I'm not hugely spiritually like engaged, but I remember it felt like the clouds parted. I remember just like hearing this voice and it was like, if you don't make this work, you're going to have to come home. And I remember thinking to myself, do you know what? I didn't come this far to come this far. And if she doesn't like me for the work I do, that's absolutely fine. It's just not a match. But if I give in to this feeling of fear, and just because I could feel it growing from my chest, I could feel it was like it was going into my arms. I could feel it going into my legs. It's like this, it's like a smoke that comes over your whole body of fear. And I remember I was just like moving a hair around like hairdressers do. They just kind of move it. And I was thinking, I need something to happen. And I remember just thinking in my head, I just thought, fuck this. Let me try this wig. Like, I know this is going to look great. So I picked up the wig and I put it on her. I was like, let's just try this. I think this could be really cool. And she's like, oh, actually, wow. And it fit really good. And the color was nice. And she was like, oh, I like it. So I put it on her head in like 10 minutes and she ran off for a live TV show. And then there was a little break and she looked over at me on the break. I was sort of standing by the sidelines ready to touch her up. And she said, everyone likes your wig. And then kind of look back and engage in the conversation. It was a small conversation, but that's all I needed to hear. And in that moment, I just remember thinking to myself, like, if I had not done me, if I hadn't, you know, and I wasn't being cocky. I knew every aspect of hair. I trained, I learned. I wasn't just trying to wing it. I genuinely knew my craft. But I went back to being 6-year-old Chris at the window. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, I am 30-year-old Chris now, and I know what I'm doing. I'm going to lead with confidence and I'm going to lead with the man I am today.
Yes.
Not a version of myself as I was as a child at 6 years old, which a lot of us revert back to. We don't even realize we're doing it. And in that moment, I knew I'd done it. I did it. And that was the beginning of my career in Hollywood. People started to see our hair on The Voice. We did those hoops in the hair and became a whole thing. And we were doing different colors, like a lavender color. And she had these updos. And that kind of, again, started to make people see me in Hollywood. Like, oh, who's doing the hair? Like, there's this new guy in town. it's just a knock-on effect. But it was a really defining moment. And I honestly, if I'd have just given in to the fear, I probably wouldn't be here now.
Yeah.
I don't think my story would have ever been here to tell, because I would have just been a version of myself that I'm not anymore. And that's why if that can happen for me, if I can put that into a book that can help other people realize that. Do you know how many times that happens to people where they just go back to a version of themselves?
Absolutely.
That's not healed and is a bit lost, you know, and coming back to yourself and redefining who you are is possible.
Yeah.
But you just got to see it first.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is so empowering because, as you say, most people have had that experience where even though they've worked so hard for a moment, they've worked towards maybe it's a big pitch for a new client or you know, whatever it is, and they will do all that work, and then the minute comes and they get there and that imposter syndrome just comes in, and they just think, I am not ready for this, and all they just revert to their younger selves.
Totally.
And I think it's so empowering to hear you kind of speak about that experience and how you actually managed your own inner voice and you chose a different thought. You chose to think differently in that moment.
Yeah.
And I think it's really good to remind people that you can do that too. You can actually don't expect that thought not to be there.
No.
Inner voice is going to try and
always
kind of rear its head. But how can you manage it and how can you learn to rise above it?
Totally. And you just learn to, like you say, it's like, you just learn to navigate it. You're like, oh, that's that thing. That's that voice. But I'm going to come back to myself. You know, you, it just doesn't stay as long and it's not as paralyzing and you don't, you know, because you become used to it. I mean, I'm sure, I don't know, maybe, I mean, you've wrote a book on confidence. Like, I'm sure people think you've got it all together all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't think any of us have.
No, God, no.
It's a process.
Yeah, yeah. Insecurity is very much a universal experience.
Totally. Yeah. And I think like more people need to share that and realize it's okay. It's what you do with it.
Yeah, I agree. Right. You have been Kim Kardashian's hairstylist for years. I mean, I'm quite obsessed with it. You, Mario, and Kim, it's like the dream team. And I think you
the
guys, you really did something for glam teams on the whole, I think, from the outside. Yeah, I think it really, I am sure, and I know from lots of hairstylists I've worked with and makeup artists, you guys have really inspired people with to thrive in their own professions. And I think for people to give the spotlight to the glam teams behind, you know, the artist or celebrity that you're doing glam for.
Yeah.
When was the first time you met Kim?
I remember it very well. I think a makeup artist recommended me to do her hair. And I remember we did this like short wig. It was like a side parted short kind of wig, like a blunt wig, which was quite a different look for her. And I remember she walked in and she's like, oh, I heard so much about you. And she had this really nice voice. We did an interview not long ago and I was like, you don't have that voice anymore. I was like, well, you don't talk to me in that voice anymore. She was laughing. She's now more like, you know, more, no. I mean, it was just like, I remember definingly her walking in, like, I've heard a lot about you. And I was like, oh, you heard a lot about me. What? You know, but whatever. I just got into it. And yeah, I mean, Kim is obviously such an inspiration because she's genuinely a great person. I mean, a lot of people know her to be, you know, businesswoman, but you know, beyond that, I see her as a mother and as a friend, and the person she is, she's always so inspiring to be around. And you know, it doesn't matter who walks in the room, whether it's, you know, an agent or a manager or just an, or, you know, I don't know, like an assistant or a lighting guy, she will always introduce herself, and she's so kind and polite to everyone she meets, and it's genuine. So she's always been a big inspiration to me, if someone that does have it all or seems to be, but also she's just so real and authentic.
Yeah.
And we always have such a good time. And you know, it's nice that you say that about glam team. And you know, I think she, you know, the Kardashians have been so good at like celebrating their glam team and celebrating the people that, you know, help them. And, you know, obviously recently with like Chris, and since she had her face done, and I've recently started doing her hair, and, you know, having so much fun because it's so nice to see someone be fearless in reinventing themselves and also having fun at the same time, not taking it too seriously.
Yeah.
And you know, that for me has always been my goal. So to be able to do it at any age, it's just a reminder to everyone out there. And people go, oh, well, if you've got money, or if you've got that, it's not all about appearance. It can start with a small thing of just changing the haircut you've had your whole life and how powerful. I mean, Chris, all that, you know, she had that short pixie look, and we were doing these longer looks and pinning the hair up and doing different looks.
Oh my God,
and it changed
pixie
a lot.
Wig you just did.
Oh yeah.
Oh, I was obsessed.
So cute, right?
I think it's so cool that you do wigs.
I just think it's fun to be able to change it up and see a different version of yourself.
Yes.
And if anyone can take anyone from anything, it's just like I say, it's a small, it doesn't have to be a huge thing. It can be a small thing you start with.
Yeah. I just got a clip-in fringe. And ooh, when I put it in, I do just feel like I step into a character of myself.
Character,
and I think with every hairstyle you do on yourself.
Yeah.
And so I feel like, and like you've kind of mentioned, people get used to a hairstyle that they have all the time. Mm. But maybe actually, even after listening to this, they could go and just try something new and see how they feel.
Totally. And expect to feel uncomfortable. Expect to feel not sure. That's great.
Yeah.
That's usually the time where you start to change. Mm. The worst moments in my life have probably been the biggest time for change. You know, change isn't just like easy. It's not like, hell yeah, like, change is like the unknown. So it's okay to be unsure.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why, you know, it's great to work around people or work with people that kind of give you a bit of a guideline into it's okay to feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. It's okay to not feel sure.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to change your mind as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a freedom in it.
Absolutely. Chris, how do you make yourself feel confident today?
I think confidence for me is now realizing that you can redefine yourself at any age or any stage in your life. Sometimes you just need a little help in how to do that.
Absolutely. What are some of the things that have helped you? Different therapies, rituals,
technique? Yeah, I mean, I'm big on therapy. I love doing therapy. I like to understand why. I like to understand why we make the decisions we make, why we get ourselves into the situations we get ourselves into, how to break that pattern.
Yeah.
So I'm big on therapy and I love to sort of really go into it with my therapist. Why do we do this? Why do we behave this way? Why do we respond to that in that way? Or, you know, I like to see it because once you see it, you can change it.
Absolutely.
But also for me, like my kids, wanting to be a good dad for my kids, making them, you know, I hope the biggest thing I've ever had said to me is from my kids that they're proud of me. I mean, that's so my life goal was to, you know, make them proud. And I think as a dad, that's, you know, I get a lot of confidence from that.
Yeah.
I think also working out, it's not just about vanity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like to look good. I like to have, I don't know. I think I'm 42 now. I want good posture. I think working out is good for your body, but also just mentally, it's really good because it's like an hour of the day that I have to myself and I can, it's about me.
Yeah.
And I like to keep that because it can quite quickly in my job be about everyone else.
Mm.
So I try not to lose myself with that and come back to myself. And that's a time for me.
Yeah.
It's a time for Chris, little Chris, you know, where I'm, you know, doing something I enjoy and, you know, it also releases those endorphins. So you're feeling good about yourself.
Yeah.
And also just laughter. Like I like having fun. I like letting my hair down. I never used to want to stop. Now I do less than I used to do because I think for a long time I was running. I'm not running anymore. I'm off the treadmill and I'm more in my life rather than running away from it.
Yeah.
Even just, you know, we were talking about the UK and for a long time I couldn't go back to the UK because it was a version of myself that I felt ashamed of or, that I didn't want to remember, but now I celebrate it. And, you know, just going back to the UK now, I have a house with my family and that's been the most rewarding part of my career is being able to do that because I think it was a real 360 for me to feel confident in going home and bringing those two versions of myself together, was very healing and knowing they're all me. They're all parts of me because it's my life.
Absolutely.
And I'm proud of all of them. I'm proud of every journey that I've been through and overcome and or failed flat on my face, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I chose to, you know, get up and take on the next day.
Yeah.
And it's nice. It's also really nice to like take off the mask and be like, everything I posted on social media was a lie, you know, because a big version of it was just pretending that I was okay. And there's a lot of times I wasn't.
Yeah.
A lot of times I didn't know what the next thing. And I think we all have a version of that to ourselves.
Sure.
And there's something very sort of powerful in just sort of being in that and sharing it with people. And people go, you know, I think I've not, I don't really post everything when I'm feeling bad either. You know, I think I maybe been lying on my social media. You know, it's nice to start a conversation of allowing people to realize that life's not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
People are messy.
Yeah.
And, you know, but you can come back from that and you can learn from that and create something beautiful from it.
Yeah, absolutely. And your book, Your Roots Don't Define You, is out on January the 20th.
Yeah.
And I'm so excited for everyone to read it. I think your story is so inspirational. I think your vulnerability is going to help so many people.
Thank you.
Truly, I think it makes them feel less alone. I love your message about stepping into the character of who you want to become, redefining yourself
at
any age, at any point, and not needing to wait for some big shock moment for that to open. You can choose, you know what? I want to do this differently.
Totally.
I want to show this side of myself that I never showed before.
Yeah. Or just is like, if anyone just sits there thinking, is this it? Is this it? You know, for anyone that's like questioning that, pick up the book and take a read, because you'll usually find it's not just it. It's just the beginning.
Absolutely. Okay. Before we end, we've just got a very quick fire.
Yeah.
Okay. Sure. Best career advice you ever got?
Feel the fear and do it anyway.
Oh, and also a fantastic book. Yeah. Worst hairstyle trend and one you secretly miss?
I don't love mullets. So I don't know.
I'm with you on that.
It can look cool. I just don't love a mullet. And one I secretly miss. I love like the old Hollywood glamour, like Marilyn Monroe. I can't believe they got those hairstyles back then, because they're hard to do even now. And like, they just look so perfect back in the day, you know, these sort of pinup icons.
That's so true. Okay, one beauty product you take on every trip.
One beauty product I take on every trip. I love my Color Wow.
It's the best.
Root powder. Because it just fell in the hairline. Especially if you're on camera, you can see everything.
Yeah.
And it just kind of, you can lower your hairline, you can cover grays. It's a great little thing.
For anyone that doesn't know, the root powder is like a hair makeup.
Yeah.
It's definitely my secret weapon as well.
It doesn't go anywhere.
It's so good. Yeah. It really is amazing. Three words that describe you now.
I think I would say grateful, present, and evolving.
Oh, I love those. Yeah. I'm a big fan of those words.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Great answer. Okay. And finally, what does rising mean to you?
Coming to a place of realization that it's never too late. And no matter where you're at in your life, you can redefine the story. You can change the story. You can re-identify, you can reinvent yourself at any age. And just starting with that is enough, because it's just the beginning.
That is so beautiful. Chris, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's such a beautiful thing that you've created, and your books are fabulous.
Thank you.
I'm definitely going to be stealing those and keeping them in my back pocket. And I think, you know, I'm so grateful to be able to share a platform with someone as amazing as you, because what you've done has helped so many people. So
to
be a small part of that today is something I'm really grateful for. So thank you for giving me the platform to share it.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Yay.
Thank you so much for listening to Rise with Roxy. Chris's story is such a powerful reminder that confidence is created through consistency, not circumstances. He shows us that you can come from anywhere, face anything, and still build a career of dreams. If this episode inspired you, please follow the podcast, leave a review, and share with someone who might need this message today. You can connect with us on Instagram at risewithroxy, or you can email your thoughts to risewithroxy@bowermedia.co.uk. Until next time, keep rising.
This was a Rayo Original Podcast.